All right, listeners, are you ready for this? Today, we're diving deep into a Supreme Court case that's, it's a real head-scratcher, honestly.
It really is.
We're talking about religious freedom, but also animal sacrifice.
Mm-hmm.
Specifically, the Santeria religion. Have you heard of it?
I'm sure some of our listeners have.
It's fascinating, really. But it also sparked a lot of controversy, especially in this case we're looking at today. Church of the Lukumi Babalu I versus City of Hialeah.
Yeah, it went all the way to the Supreme Court.
It did. And the question was basically, could a city actually ban animal sacrifice, even if it was part of a religion?
Big questions about the First Amendment in this one.
Absolutely. So before we get into the legal nitty-gritty, let's set the stage a little bit. Can you give us a quick rundown on Santeria, you know, for those who might not be familiar?
Sure. Santeria is it's a blend of traditions, really.
Yeah.
It has its roots in the Yoruba religion of West Africa, brought to Cuba, you know, centuries ago by enslaved Africans.
Mm.
And over time, it mixed with elements of Catholicism. But a key part of Santeria is animal sacrifice. It's how practitioners connect with their deities, the orishas.
So it's not just some, you know, random act of violence. It's a deeply spiritual practice for them.
Exactly. It's about offering communion, connecting with the divine.
Got it. So how did this all lead to a Supreme Court showdown?
Well, the Church of the Lukumi Babalu I, they wanted to establish a church in Hialeah, Florida.
Seems simple enough.
Right. But word got out about their practices, specifically the animal sacrifice. And let's just say it didn't go over well with everyone in the community.
People freaked out.
Pretty much. There was fear, outrage, you name it. People saw it as cruel, barbaric. The city council felt the pressure, and well, they reacted quickly.
They didn't waste any time, huh?
Nope. They passed a whole bunch of ordinances aimed at, well, stopping the church from doing its thing.
Banning animal sacrifice outright.
That was the gist of it. No animal sacrifice is allowed, basically. But, and here's where it gets interesting, the language of those ordinances. It wasn't exactly straightforward.
Ah, so there's a twist. Always a twist.
Right, like how they defined sacrifice and slaughter. It got really specific, and that's what landed this case in the Supreme Court's lap.
They had to figure out if the city was truly being neutral, like they claimed, or if they were trying to target Santeria specifically.
Bingo. Was it just about protecting animals, or was there something else going on?
Like what?
Well, the court had to consider this idea of religious gerrymandering.
Religious gerrymandering. Okay, I might need a little help with that one. What does that even mean?
It's like, imagine redrawing voting districts to benefit one party over another.
Okay, I've heard of that.
But in this case, it's about drawing lines to exclude a specific religious practice. So the ordinances, for example, they had exemptions for things like kosher slaughter.
So killing animals is okay if it's for that reason, but not for Santeria.
That's the kind of thing the court had to untangle.
Sounds like a pretty blatant violation of the First Amendment, right? Freedom of religion and all that.
That's exactly what the church argued. They said these ordinances were a direct attack on their right to freely practice their religion.
And the Supreme Court had to decide if that was the case.
Yeah, they had to figure out if these laws were truly neutral and generally applicable, or if they were designed to single out and suppress Santeria.
And if they decided that the city was being discriminatory,
then they'd have to strike down those ordinances.
So what happened? Did the city pass the test? Were those laws truly neutral?
Well, that's where things get even more interesting. The court brought out the big guns for this one. They applied strict scrutiny to these ordinances.
Strict scrutiny. I feel like I've heard that term before, but I can't quite remember what it means.
It's the highest level of judicial review. It's like the Supreme Court saying, okay, we're taking this very seriously. It's triggered when a law is infringing on a fundamental right, like, you know, freedom of religion.
So the bar is set pretty high for the government in these cases.
It's extremely high. They have to prove that the law is absolutely necessary to achieve a super important government goal.
A compelling state interest, right?
That's the term. And they also have to show that there's no other way to achieve that goal that's less restrictive of people's rights.
So in this case, the city had to convince the court that banning animal sacrifice was essential, that there was no other way to address their concerns.
And those concerns, by the way, were public health and preventing cruelty to animals.
Okay, those sound pretty legitimate.
Right. So it seems like a slam dunk for the city. But, well, the court wasn't buying it.
Why not? Weren't those concerns valid?
They were. But the problem was the court felt the city's solution, you know, this total ban on animal sacrifice, it was just too broad, way too broad.
Like they were swinging for the fences when a bunt would have done.
Exactly. They went overboard. The ordinances prohibited way more religious conduct than was actually necessary to achieve those goals of protecting public health and animals.
Ah, so the court saw it as overkill, yeah. Essentially.
Yes. And remember those exemptions we talked about.
Right, for kosher slaughter and all that.
Well, the fact that Hialeah didn't regulate hunting or fishing, you know, even regular slaughterhouses with the same strictness.
That does seem a little suspicious.
Yeah. The court saw that as evidence that the city wasn't being truly neutral. They were picking and choosing, targeting Santeria while letting other forms of animal killing slide.
So the city failed the strict scrutiny test, huh?
They failed spectacularly. And the Supreme Court, they struck those ordinances down as unconstitutional, a clear violation of the Free Exercise Clause.
Wow. So this case was about way more than just animal sacrifice.
So much more. It was a powerful statement about the limits of government power, you know, about protecting religious freedom, even when it makes people uncomfortable.
Even when it's something that a lot of people might find strange or even offensive.
Right. It's about protecting the rights of all, not just the majority.
And Justice Kennedy, he really drove that point home, didn't he?
He did. He said, and I'm quoting here, official action that targets religious conduct for distinctive treatment cannot be shielded by mere compliance with the requirement of facial neutrality.
Whoa, powerful stuff.
It is. Basically, he's saying you can't hide discriminatory intent behind seemingly neutral laws. The impact matters, not just the words.
That's a pretty clear message to the government. Don't even try to play games with religious freedom.
Right. But here's the thing. While the court was unanimous in its decision.
Everyone agreed.
Yep. But there were actually four concurring opinions.
Four. So even though they all agreed that the ordinances were unconstitutional, they had different reasons for getting there.
Exactly. Each justice had their own take on why these laws were a problem, which makes this case even more fascinating. It shows just how complex the issue of religious freedom really is.
Okay, we've got Justices Scalia, Souter, and Blackmun all weighing in. This is where things get really juicy, exploring their different interpretations and seeing how they add to this whole debate about religious freedom.
Each one brings a unique perspective, and trust me, they don't always see eye to eye.
Sounds like a legal thriller waiting to unfold. So we've got this clash over animal sacrifice, a city trying to shut down a religious practice, and the Supreme Court stepping in to protect the right to freely exercise one's faith.
We've got the Free Exercise Clause, religious gerrymandering, strict scrutiny, a lot of legal heavy hitters in the ring.
And those concurring opinions, that's where the real debate gets going. It's not just about whether the city was right or wrong, but about how we define the boundaries of religious freedom, how we balance individual rights with the government's authority, and how those lines are constantly being redrawn.
Buckle up, listeners, because we're about to dive headfirst into the minds of the justices and see what they had to say about all of this.
We're about to untangle those threads and see what insights we can pull out.
Okay, let's start with Justice Scalia. He's known for his, shall we say, strict interpretation of the Constitution.
Always a stickler for the rules. What was his take on this whole thing?
Well, he agreed that the ordinances were unconstitutional, but he really hammered on this idea of general applicability. For him, that was the key issue.
Wait, hold on. Didn't we already talk about that?
Mm-hmm.
What's the difference between general applicability and facial neutrality? I'm getting my legal terms all mixed up.
It can be tricky. Facial neutrality means a law doesn't specifically target a religion, you know, in its wording. It looks neutral on the surface.
Right. Got it.
But general applicability, that's about how the law is actually enforced in practice. Even if a law looks neutral on paper, if it's used in a way that unfairly burdens a particular religion.
Ah, so it's about the impact, not just the words.
Exactly. And Scalia felt that the Hialeah ordinances, well, they weren't generally applicable. They were enforced in a way that targeted Santeria, plain and simple.
So it's like saying you can't just hide discrimination behind vague language. You have to look at what's really going on.
That was his point. He said the focus should be on the object of the law, you know, its real world effect, not on trying to guess what was in the lawmakers' heads.
Sounds like a pretty practical approach.
He was all about clarity and objectivity.
I can see why he was such a big deal on the court. Okay, so that's Scalia's view. What about Justice Souter? What were his main concerns?
Ah, Souter. He was worried about something much bigger. He used this case as an opportunity to raise concerns about the court's whole approach to religious freedom. Specifically, he was worried about the Smith rule.
Oh, yeah, the Smith rule. I think we've touched on that before.
We have. But can you remind our listeners what that rule was all about and why it caused so much controversy?
It was about those two Native American guys who were fired for using peyote.
Yes. In religious ceremony.
Right. A religious ceremony.
Yeah.
And they got denied unemployment benefits because of it. Which seems kind of unfair.
It did seem unfair to many. The Supreme Court, though, they upheld that denial. They said the state's law against peyote use, it was a neutral law of general applicability, so it didn't violate the free exercise clause.
Wait, but that means you could have a law that doesn't even mention religion?
Yeah.
But if it ends up preventing someone from practicing their faith?
It's okay under the Smith rule.
Seriously? That seems like a pretty big loophole.
And that's exactly what worried Justice Souter. He thought the Smith rule created this two-tiered system for religious freedom.
Two tiers. Okay, I'm listening.
One for laws that specifically target religion, and another for laws that are neutral and generally applicable.
So, if a law explicitly targets a religion, strict scrutiny, but if it's neutral and generally applicable, even if it burdens religious practice, it gets a free pass.
That's pretty much it. And Souter felt strongly that the Free Exercise Clause should protect individuals from any law that significantly burdens their religious practice, regardless of intent.
So he's saying intent shouldn't matter. If a law makes it harder to practice your religion, the court should step in.
Yeah. He believed the court should scrutinize any law that has a major impact on religious practices, even if the law doesn't directly target a religion. He was calling for a broader, more robust protection of religious freedom.
I can see why he was concerned about the Smith rule. It seems like it could be used to justify all sorts of restrictions on religious practice. Okay, so we've got Scalia focused on the object of the law, and Souter worried about the broader implications of the Smith rule. Now, what about Justice Blackmun? Where did he stand on all of this?
Well, Justice Blackmun, he actually continued to hold the view that the Smith case was just plain wrong.
He didn't mince words, did he?
He did not. He saw it as a step backward for religious freedom, a departure from the way the court had interpreted the Free Exercise Clause in the past. He argued that the Smith rule basically reduces the Free Exercise Clause to just an anti-discrimination principle.
So instead of protecting religious freedom broadly, it's only about preventing targeted attacks on religion.
That was his concern. And he felt it didn't do enough to accommodate religious practices, even when they might bump up against neutral laws. He actually highlighted how a law can be problematic, not just by being overly broad, like those ordinances in Hialeah.
Right, casting too wide a net.
Exactly. But also by being under-inclusive.
Under-inclusive. Okay, now I'm really lost. What does that mean?
Think of it this way. If a law says it's aiming for some important goal, like protecting public health, for example,
sure.
It can't just pick and choose which activities to regulate. It has to apply equally to anything that poses a similar risk.
So no special treatment.
Exactly. And in the Lukumi case, Blackmun argued that the city's ordinances, they were under-inclusive because they targeted religious animal sacrifice.
But not other forms of animal killing.
Right. Which, to Blackmun, suggested that the city's real motivation wasn't actually about protecting public health or animals. It was about going after a religious practice they didn't like.
Okay, so all three concurring opinions, even though they agree on the outcome, are basically saying the city's ordinances were flawed in different ways.
They are, and I think that's what makes this case so fascinating. There are so many layers to the legal arguments, so many different ways to approach the issue of religious freedom.
Like they're each shining a light on a different part of the problem, helping us see the full picture.
And that's why we need to explore all these perspectives. It's not about finding one right answer, but about understanding the full range of ideas at play.
Absolutely. It's about grasping the complexity of this whole debate about religious freedom and how we balance individual rights with the interests of society as a whole.
You know, thinking about it, it's interesting how this whole case impacted the Santeria community itself.
Oh, yeah, we haven't really talked about that.
They were the ones, you know, at the center of this whole battle.
That's true. What happened to them after the Supreme Court ruled in their favor? Like, what did this win actually mean for them?
It was huge EE for them, like a landmark victory.
I bet.
Not just for this particular church, the Lukumi Babalu Eye, but for, you know, religious minorities everywhere.
Right.
It was a powerful statement, you know, saying that they have the right to practice their beliefs, even if those beliefs might seem weird or even offensive to other people.
So it wasn't just about the animal sacrifice itself.
Yeah.
It was about something bigger, like the freedom to be different, to believe things that other people might not agree with or understand.
Exactly. It sent a message, you know, loud and clear that the government can't just ban religion practices because they're unpopular or people don't get them.
Yeah, that makes sense. I can only imagine what this must have felt like for the Santeria community, to have the Supreme Court, you know, the highest court in the land, come down on their side after all that discrimination and hostility they faced. That must have been pretty amazing.
Oh, it was a huge turning point for them. It gave them the freedom to practice their religion openly without fear.
It basically paved the way for greater understanding and acceptance of Santeria as a legitimate religion.
Exactly. And it's important to remember that religious freedom, it's not just about protecting the rights of the majority.
Right.
It's about protecting everyone, even those whose beliefs might be outside the mainstream, you know?
Yeah, totally. This case really highlights that.
The Lukumi case, it really helped to solidify that idea in American law.
It showed that the courts are there to protect those who are different, those whose beliefs clash with what's considered normal or acceptable.
Exactly.
It's like drawing a line in the sand and saying, hey, the government can't cross this line. You can't tell people what to believe.
That's a great way to put it. And that principle, it's still relevant today. You know, it shapes how we approach religious freedom even now.
That's really powerful.
Yeah.
But speaking of things that are still relevant today, let's go back to Justice Souter for a minute.
Okay.
Remember how he was all worried about that Smith rule? He thought it needed a serious overhaul.
Right. He felt like it didn't offer enough protection for religious practices that might be burdened by laws that seem neutral on the surface.
Yeah, exactly. So what happened after the Lukumi case? Did the Supreme Court ever go back and, you know, fix that Smith rule?
Well, they did look at it again in a few different cases.
They did.
But they didn't completely get rid of it. It's still around causing trouble.
So it's still a big debate in legal circles.
Oh, yeah. The Smith rule is like a thorn in the side of religious freedom law. It keeps popping up, causing all sorts of controversy and uncertainty.
Can you give us an example of a case where the Smith rule came up after the Lukumi case?
Sure. There's the Burwell v. Hobby Lobby Stores case.
Hobby Lobby, that rings a bell.
Mm-hmm.
I think I remember that one being in the news a while
back. It was a big one. This case was decided in 2014, and it involved a family-owned business, a corporation with strong religious beliefs.
Okay.
They really didn't want to provide certain types of contraceptives to their employees.
I remember that part. They said it went against their religious beliefs.
Right. So how did the Smith rule come into play? Well, the government said, look, the Affordable Care Act, you know, Obamacare, it requires contraceptive coverage. It's a neutral law. It applies to everyone, regardless of religion. So, under the Smith rule, Hobby Lobby shouldn't get a pass.
Hmm. It sounds like they were trying to use the Smith rule to force Hobby Lobby to comply.
They were, but the court wasn't having it.
Really? They sided with Hobby Lobby?
Yep. In a 5-4 decision.
Wow. Close call.
It was. They decided that the contraceptive mandate was too much of a burden on the owner's religious beliefs and that there were other ways for the government to achieve its goals without forcing Hobby Lobby to violate their conscience.
So they basically made an exception to the Smith rule for Hobby Lobby.
You could say that, but they did it by using another law, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, or RFRA for short.
Okay, hold up. Now there's another law involved.
Mm-hmm.
What is this RFRA thing, and how does it fit into all of this?
RFRA is kind of a big deal. Congress passed it back in 1993, and it was a direct response to that Smith decision.
Ah, so they were trying to fix what they saw as a problem with the Smith rule.
Exactly. They wanted to make it harder for the government to infringe on religious freedom.
Makes sense. So what does RFRA actually do?
Basically, it says that if the government is going to do something that puts a big burden on someone's religious practice, they have to have a really good reason for doing it, and they have to do it in the least restrictive way possible.
So it's bringing back that strict scrutiny standard we talked about earlier.
Exactly. Even if a law is neutral and generally applicable, like the contraceptive mandate was supposed to be,
the government still has to jump through hoops to justify it.
Yep. So in the Hobby Lobby case, the Supreme Court said RFRA protected the company's religious freedom.
Even though the contraceptive mandate was supposed to apply to everyone.
That's right. But here's the catch. RFRA, it only applies to federal laws.
Oh, okay.
So that Smith rule, it's still in play when it comes to state and local laws.
So the Smith rule is still alive, But it's not the end-all be-all when it comes to religious freedom claims.
Exactly. Cases like Hobby Lobby show that the courts are looking for ways to protect religious freedom, even if it means getting creative.
It sounds like a constant battle, trying to find the right balance between religious freedom and the government's need to, you know, enforce its laws.
That's exactly what it is, a constant balancing act. And it's something that courts are dealing with all the time.
So, the Smith rule is still out there, but it's not the only factor in these cases. The Lukumi case, and cases like Hobby Lobby, they've shown that the courts are willing to step in and protect religious practices, even if those practices clash with laws that seem neutral at first glance.
That's right.
It's a reminder that the law, it's not static. It's constantly evolving, adapting to the changes happening in society.
It's like a living, breathing thing.
Exactly. And that means the conversation about religious freedom, it's never really over.
Never over. It's ongoing.
So where does that leave us now? What are some of the big challenges we're facing today when it comes to religious freedom, especially after all these landmark cases we've been talking about?
Well, one of the biggest challenges is figuring out how to protect religious freedom without letting it trample on other important rights and values.
Like what?
Things like equality, non-discrimination, access to health care. You know, religious freedom can't be a free pass to discriminate against others or deny them basic rights.
That's where it gets really tricky. How do we draw the line between protecting sincere religious beliefs and making sure that people aren't harmed in the process?
That's the million-dollar question. And honestly, there's no easy answer.
It's a constant struggle trying to find that balance.
It is. And cases like Lukumi and Hobby Lobby, they give us some guidance, but they don't solve everything.
They remind us that the government can't single out religious practices for bad treatment.
Right.
But they also acknowledge that the government has a responsibility to protect everyone.
It's a puzzle. Trying to fit all these pieces together in a way that makes sense and respects both religious freedom and the rights of all people.
So we've come a long way from that animal sacrifice controversy in Hialeah, Florida.
We have.
We've seen how the Lukumi case went all the way to the Supreme Court, how it impacted the Santeria community, and how it sparked this whole debate about the Smith rule and what it means for religious freedom in America.
And along the way, we've bumped up against some really big questions about what it means to live in a free and diverse society.
Yeah, questions about how to balance individual rights with the needs of the community, how to protect those who are different, and how to make sure the government doesn't overstep its bounds.
And those questions, they're still relevant today.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So as we wrap up this part of our deep dive,
yeah,
we've laid out the historical context, we've explored those complex legal arguments, and we've even peeked inside the minds of the Supreme Court justices.
We have.
But there's one more piece to this puzzle.
There is.
The legacy of the Lukumi case and what it means for the future of religious freedom.
It's a big one. And it's something we need to explore carefully if we want to understand where we are now and where we might be headed.
Okay, so we've talked about the Lukumi case, you know, what happened, the legal arguments, all that.
Mm-hmm.
But what about, like, the big picture? What does this all mean moving forward?
It's a great question. I mean, Lukumi, it really set a precedent, right? It's a powerful reminder that the government can't just go around regulating religious practices all willy-nilly. It has to be done carefully, thoughtfully, and it's not enough for a law to just, like, look neutral on the surface.
Right. We've talked about that.
The impact, the way it's actually applied, those things matter just as much.
So it's not just about the words, but about the real-world effects.
Exactly. And Lukumi showed us that courts are willing to really scrutinize laws, you know, even if those laws don't specifically target a certain religion.
They're going to look deeper, make sure things are actually fair.
Right. So for religious minorities, it's like a shield, you know, protecting them from laws that might seem neutral but actually have discriminatory effects.
Powerful stuff.
It is. And we've seen Lukumi's impact in so many cases since then. Like, all sorts of legal battles have been influenced by this decision.
Like, what kinds of cases? Give us some examples.
Well, think about land use and zoning. Religious groups, they often face pushback when they're trying to build new places of worship.
Oh, yeah. That makes sense.
Sometimes it's the local community or zoning boards.
It's like a modern-day version of what that church in Hialeah went through.
Exactly. They just want a place to practice their faith, but they run into all these obstacles.
And Lukumi comes in to save the day.
Well, Lukumi has definitely provided a framework for challenging those kinds of discriminatory zoning practices.
So courts have used Lukumi to strike down laws that unfairly target religious groups.
They have. And it's not just about buildings either. Lukumi's been cited in cases about all sorts of things, from religious dress codes to the use of, you know, sacramental substances.
Wow, so it's having a pretty big ripple effect.
It is. It's shaped how we think about religious freedom in a lot of different contexts.
That's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
But you said earlier that there are also new challenges emerging, right? Things that maybe the Lukumi case didn't really foresee.
Yeah, that's true. The world's changing and the law has to keep up, you know?
Makes sense. What are some of those new challenges?
Well, one area that's especially complex is the whole intersection of religious freedom and anti-discrimination laws.
Ooh, yeah, that's a big one.
It is. We're seeing more and more cases where people are claiming religious exemptions from laws that prohibit discrimination based on, you know, sexual orientation or gender identity.
Yeah, like when a baker doesn't want to make a cake for a same-sex wedding.
Exactly. Those kinds of cases. And it's really tough because you've got two important rights bumping up against each other.
The right to religious freedom and the right to be free from discrimination.
Right. And figuring out how to balance those, it's a huge challenge for courts and lawmakers.
There are no easy answers, that's for sure.
Not at all. Lukumi gives us some guidance, but it doesn't lay out a clear solution for these kinds of situations.
It reminds us that the government can't just target religious practices because it disagrees with them.
Right.
But it also recognizes that the government has an obligation to protect everyone's rights.
It's a balancing act, like we've been saying.
A very delicate balancing act.
And as our society continues to change and these issues become even more prominent, we're going to see more and more cases pushing those boundaries, testing the limits of Lukumi, and forcing the courts to really grapple with what religious freedom means in the 21st century.
So it's an ongoing process.
It is. It's a conversation that's never really over.
Yeah.
And the Lukumi case, it's going to keep playing a crucial role in that conversation.
Well, I think we've covered a lot of ground today. We've really delved deep into the Lukumi case, and I hope our listeners have a better understanding of what it was all about.
Me too.
We talked about the historical context, the legal battles, the Supreme Court's decision.
Those concurring opinions, they were something else.
They were. And we've seen how this case has continued to shape how we think about religious freedom in America.
It's a reminder that the law, it's not just a bunch of dusty old rules.
Yeah.
It's a living thing, constantly evolving and adapting to the world around us.
And as we move forward, as we face new challenges and try to figure out how to live together in a society that's increasingly diverse, cases like Lukumi, they're going to be essential.
They really are.
They remind us of the importance of protecting everyone's rights, even when those rights clash, and of finding ways to balance competing interests in a way that's fair and just.
That's a great way to put it.
So as we wrap up this deep dive,
yeah,
we want to thank you for joining us on this journey.
Thanks for listening, everyone.
We hope you've learned something new and that you'll continue to explore these issues, to challenge your own assumptions, and to engage in thoughtful conversations about what it means to live in a free and diverse society.
Absolutely. Keep those minds curious.
And until next time, this is The Deep Dive, signing off.